Last year, Vera Lynn turned 100. And to celebrate that fact, a record company brought out a new album of her music. And it was rather ingenious. They got hold of the original wax cylinder recordings of Vera Lynn with the then orchestra, and they somehow extracted her voice from the background sound of the orchestra. And then they did something digital to her voice, so it sounded as though it was fresh and new, recorded just yesterday. Then they superimposed it onto new orchestration, and that is the album of her songs. And it is truly wonderful. And it got to number one in the hit parade. So Vera Lynn at 100 is the oldest person by miles to be top of the pops, which is doubly wonderful. Now, Vera Lynn was always known, and still is known, as the Forces sweetheart, and so she was. And that wonderful, clear, bell-like voice with just that hint of passion was just what servicemen round the world needed to hear during the war years. And she was one of the early exponents of crooning. And crooning simply means singing at ordinary speaking volume rather than with a sort of operatic boom. And it was made possible by one of the high-tech inventions of that time, namely the microphone. And so crooning became popular in America and then spread to England via such people as Vera Lynn. And so it gives the singing a kind of intimacy that the sort of operatic boom doesn't have. And so servicemen dotted round, it was felt they were just, she was singing just for them. Well, near the beginning of the war, the BBC gave her her own programme called Starlight, went out once a week, and Vera Lynn singing. And then it was replaced by a rather ingenious programme called Sincerely Yours, which was a mixture of songs and talk, framed as a love letter from a sweetheart, namely Vera Lynn, to her man somewhere overseas. And this programme was taken out in shellac disc recordings to the African desert, Malaysian jungle, wherever it was there were servicemen, there would be these recordings that Vera Lynn had made of her radio programme. And it would be played out over loudspeakers with servicemen craning to hear the lovely voice of dear Vera. Huge success. But then the various colonel blimps of the home counties started writing in to the Telegraph and the Times, complaining that Vera Lynn's songs were soppy and sentimental, would reduce the moral fibre of our troops, cause us to lose the war. They must be taken off the air at once and replaced with marching music. That's what the soldiers needed here, good marching music. And the BBC, astonishingly, had at that time the Dance Music Review Committee, one sort of august committee of bureaucrats. And they panicked, and they decided that Vera Lynn must be taken off the air for fear we might lose the war. And so she was, along with 30 other crooners who were deemed to be also guilty of reducing moral fibre. And so that was that. Well, the only way that Vera Lynn could retain her role in entertaining the troops was actually to go to visit them. And so she went round the world with a small orchestra, visiting troops in the far-flung places, jungles and deserts and so on, wherever troops were, she was willing to go. And that made her bond with the troops even firmer, because they knew she was enduring great discomfort and even danger to be with them and to entertain them. She truly became the Forces' sweetheart. Well, towards the end of the war, I think the BBC decided our moral fibre was up to scratch, and they brought her programme back, but just for a few months at the end of the war. Well, as you've probably guessed, I am an unabashed Vera Lynn fan. I love her. And her rendition of White Cliffs of Dover will certainly be in my 8 Desert Island discs. It's an absolutely wonderful thing. In fact, I've got in my car a few compact discs of crooning music, of wartime crooning music, that I bought at the Imperial War Museum in Duxford. I can't get enough of it. But it's not only Vera Lynn personally that I love, it's that period. I was born in 1950, so I never knew the 40s, but the early 40s function in my imagination like a kind of golden age. I know the war was terrible, a terrible loss of life and limb, terrible loss of property and so on. It was terrible, but in my imagination, there's something rather wonderful as well, of the plucky Britons getting together and defeating the forces of evil, all that. So the whole 1940s thing, I can't get enough of. A golden age. To me, in my mind, you probably have your own golden ages. Well, golden age thinking should not be foreign to us Christians. On the contrary, the Bible, which is actually Bible, it's a series of books. The first book in it, Genesis, starts with the Golden Age, and the last book, Revelations, ends with the Golden Age, the new heaven and the new earth. And the Bible is really the story of what happens between those two Golden Ages, the one in the past, at the beginning of time, and the one at the end of time. The Bible's the story of between them. So Golden Age thinking is built in to the Christian faith. Now, when I was a teenager, I was required to read and learn large chunks of Milton's Paradise Lost. Have any of you grappled with it? No, you have, yeah. It's hard going. We suffered. But it's a slightly wonky story, actually, the way it's told. It's a story of Adam and Eve and their banishment from the Garden of Eden. Milton is obviously trying to make Adam and Eve seem wonderfully attractive and Satan seem horrible. But actually, the trouble is, they seem rather dreary, Adam and Eve, and dull, whereas Satan seems tremendously exciting and alluring, enticing, great fun. He has all the best lines. And so in the hands of a 16-year-old impressionable teenager, it was quite the wrong book to have. It made Satan what life was all about. But nonetheless, Milton was grappling with a real problem, or real question, rather. Milton had been the philosopher of Cromwell's Commonwealth Revolution. He'd provided the kind of intellectual heft, if you like. He didn't believe that somehow the Commonwealth would bring in the second coming, the new heaven and new earth, but he did believe it was the role of government, a Christian government, to try and help the Golden Age, the new heaven and new earth, on its way, to move us in that direction as much as we could. And so he tried to work that out. Now, he wrote Paradise Lost after all that. I think he wrote it in the late 1650s when he was going blind and living in a cottage in Buckinghamshire. But he was, as it were, looking back to his role as a philosopher at that time. So it raises the question in our minds, what is it about the Garden of Eden that is a golden age? What makes it so wonderful? And therefore, what, by inference, is the new heaven and the new earth all about? Because they're two ends of the one thing. Well, if you were to think of one word that the Garden of Eden was all about, it would be the word innocence. And that's a strange word. It's not quite the same as good, but it's almost the same. If you remember, in the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve didn't know the difference between good and bad, righteousness and evil. That was something, a knowledge they acquired having eaten the forbidden fruit. So actually they had no knowledge of good and bad in the Garden of Eden. They were, as it were, good by natural inclination. Not by thinking, not by teaching, but by natural inclination. That was the nature of their goodness. That was innocence. So that's one thing, innocence. The other thing we might think of in the Garden of Eden is plenty. There was lots for them to eat, enough for them to eat. They didn't gorge themselves. You don't imagine them sort of digging into peach melba and strawberries and cream and so on. They had enough. They had what they needed, what they could reasonably want. So we can think of innocence and plenty as the two kind of key characteristics. There may be more, but think of those two, of the Garden of Eden. Now, what we're talking about in the second coming, the new heaven and new earth, is the new Eden. So how can we restore innocence? Surely innocence, once lost, is lost forever. How can you go back from knowing the difference between good and evil to becoming just good? Well, we have a word that almost says that. I don't think it appears in the Bible, but somebody might correct me, but another word does. The word we use habitually is virtue. Now, most morality is about what you do. That doing that is wrong, doing that is right. Virtue is about what you are, the sort of person you are. Now, of course, that would express itself in outward actions, but virtue is what I am, or I'm not, perhaps. And vice is the opposite, virtue and vice, is what you are as a person. And we talk about cultivating virtues, becoming more virtuous. And what we mean by that is becoming more inclined, as a matter of course, of doing the right thing, of feeling the right feelings. So that's what we mean by virtue. And the word that we find in the Bible is, and I think it was Graham who read it to us, about the fruits of the Spirit. All those things like modesty, patience, self-control, love, all those things, the virtues that all of you so excel in, there they are listed in the book of, in the Epistle to the Galatians. And of course, by referring to them, by referring to them as fruits of the Spirit, he's saying that actually they come not ultimately from our own efforts, but from the Holy Spirit guiding us and uplifting us. So through the Spirit, we become virtuous, we become naturally good. We no longer have to think all the time, shall I do that, shall I do that? We can follow our natural inclinations, they become good, our innocence is restored. Now let's think of that word plenty. Over the centuries there have been many famines, and some really terrible ones. Think of Ethiopia in the 1970s, or the Bengal famine, I think about 100 years ago, the Irish potato famine of the 1840s, and so on. Really terrible famines. Now, where we know enough about them to make this sort of judgment, there's one thing that's invariably true. There's enough to go round. God never gives an ultimate shortage. There's always enough to go round. Famines occur when some people have more, so some people have nothing or too little. That's when famines occur. There may be some bad harvests bringing that about, but nonetheless, it's human greed is the ultimate cause of famine, not divine punishment of any kind. It's our greed. And so what we need to restore then is the notion of enough. Everybody should have enough. We don't all need to be equal. I don't want more than I've got. I have enough. That's fine. So enoughness is the other characteristic of Eden restored. But actually, virtue and enoughness sort of go together. Enoughness is incorporated into virtue. Because imagine a society in which people were virtuous. They would find it intolerable that that person is starving while that person is living in luxury. Virtue would lead people to demand that there should be enough for everybody, and there always is. So virtue is what it's all about. So let's bring that back to Milton, trying to find a philosophy of government. Imagine a party called Eden Restored Party. And the Eden Restored Party would have one policy, to nurture virtue and let everything else look after itself. So just imagine our schools. Their one policy, their overriding priority, is not to get people through the exams, not to do this, that, and the other. To nurture virtue. Let everything else look after itself. That's our political, and I mean political with a very, very small p, our political witness to the world is the centrality of virtue, the centrality of the fruits of the Spirit. Now, I have my own private golden age, and I think some of you may have similar private golden ages. You may remember, some of us will remember, the older ones amongst us, that back in the post-war years, there were all those childhood illnesses you needed to get through. Do you remember those? There was measles, mumps, German measles, though we had to call that rubella because German measles sounded a bit mean. Then there was, I had scarlet fever, I think. Diphtheria was really bad news. Chickenpox, of course, you had to have chickenpox. And there were chickenpox parties, do you remember those? Where you would go and mix with children with chickenpox in order to catch it. The way those illnesses happened, I mean, I remember this absolutely vividly, you'd have a few days in bed feeling rotten. And if you had a temperature, for some reason they put the fire on very, very hard, so you were dying of heat. And then you'd feel better. But you weren't allowed out of bed. You had to stay in bed for at least a week, if not longer, because bed rest was regarded as the key. And then there was that wonderful thing, quarantine. You were feeling fully better, could perfectly well go back to school, but you weren't allowed to because if you were in quarantine, you might infect some other boys. So you had this for 3 or 4 weeks of absolute wonderful freedom. So I remember being ill with tremendous nostalgia. But the thing that made it so special was that every morning, while I was ill, my mother would take the Bakelite radio, sort of that kind of size, black Bakelite thing, from her bedroom and put it in my bedroom. And I could listen to the light programme. So I, Housewife's Choice, remember that? Yeah. Where I learnt my love of crooning music. There was Music While You Work, Workers' Playtime, Mrs. Dale's Diary. I'm worried about Jim. All those wonderful programmes on the night programme. And then Granny would come in the afternoon and would play Bézique. And then in the late, early evening, there'd be those comedy programmes, The Clitheroe Kid, The Navy Lark, Meet the Huggets, Life with the Lions, Peter Brough and Educating Archie. That was the most extraordinary programme. There was a ventriloquist on the radio. What's the point of that? His career took something of a nosedive when he went on television and you could see his lips move. Anyway, I loved them all. Crooning music and comedy, I thought, was wonderful. So I have this, as I say, golden age about all that. And it makes me wonder, in the original Eden, was there music? Did they sing to each other? What do we think? I think they might have done. But it's difficult to imagine them having a laugh. Why should it be difficult? Because after all, we Christians, laughter is part of what it's about. But it's a little bit difficult. But surely in the second, the new heaven and new earth, there will be music, including crooning, which I, and there will be laughter. But I do have one story of laughter in the Garden of Eden that I think has been sort of passed down. And it's this. Adam and Eve. Adam has the habit of going out for long walks in the early evening. And Eve begins to get suspicious. She wonders if she's seeing another woman. And so she plucks up the courage and says to Adam, "Are you seeing another woman?" And of course he says, "Well, I can't. You're the only woman in the world." She says, "Well, how do I know I'm the only woman in the world?" And they pause. And what does he reply? "Count my ribs." That's a good reply. And that's the one bit of laughter we know about in the Garden of Eden. So I think in the second Garden of Eden, in the new heaven and new earth, they will still be ribbing each other. Oh, no, it's horrible. And telling better jokes than that one. And just one final thing before I sit down about the whole story, the story of the new heaven and the new earth. This is actually a very serious point. You probably know Stephen Hawking died recently, and in the early part of his career, he developed some equations that was a purport to show that the universe would continue indefinitely. There would be no end. Now, it's actually crucial to the Christian faith that that's not true, that there is an end. That's the whole point. That's when the general resurrection happens. Now, it emerged a few days ago that towards the end of his life, he realized those equations were flawed and that the universe will indeed come to an end. I haven't seen any other Christian picking up on that, but there we are. Stephen Hawking realizes his teaching was flawed, and he's now gone back to what effectively is the Christian teaching. Just goes to show the Bible is always right.